Hey everyone, welcome to Solutions for the Underaffiliated, the radio show to help frustrated people discover solutions to fix this mess. Today we're going to talk about healthy opportunities and social determinants, but first it's February 16th and that means it's National Innovation Day. So you have free reign to fail all day, but fail fast. Today we have Lori Stradley, who's the Executive Director of Health Impact, and she's going to be talking about a really cool innovative program today. And so, Lori, welcome. And why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thanks. This is the perfect day to talk about this. I didn't even know it was Innovation Day because that's what we're trying to do. We work across our region as a part of a statewide demonstration project to connect social health, so things like housing, transportation, and food access, to clinical health, so a diagnosis like diabetes, and make sure that people have exactly what they need to be well and live well and connect and stay healthy.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about who some of the folks are and what's the challenge and where are you taking us?
So thinking about all, this has a lot of players. Anything having to do with the American healthcare system is going to have a lot of folks involved. But the most important people in this demonstration project are members of the North Carolina Medicaid Managed Care Program. And the folks with that group are eligible for this opportunity to access greater degrees of care so they can get support with housing, maybe turn on those utilities when you're trying to think about getting into a new home. And the reason this is a demonstration site is because it's not permanent yet. We're trying to prove the process and show federal funders and state, really the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, that using healthcare dollars to provide these resources and help meet an individual's entire health needs is valuable and impactful. But if you zoom out from that and think about all the other people who are involved, we've got our Medicaid transformation underway in North Carolina with private health insurers providing Medicaid services support. We've got our physicians and practices that support folks and families all over. We've got care management groups, the person who might talk to you after you have a diabetes diagnosis and say, here's what we need to do to keep you well. We're working with really incredible human service organizations across the region. And our region is 18 counties, and Buncombe County is included in that, Asheville as well. And so when we're thinking about all these great groups who are already doing good work in community, they have relationships with families, and they're going to keep doing the work. So this is meant to funnel through the assets in our region already. The folks who provide food access, who help with housing remediation, you know, get that moldy carpet out of your house and make sure folks can breathe well. The folks who are already doing that work are the ones we're partnering with. And Impact Health serves as the network lead. We coordinate and partner with all these players to make sure that it's not messy for the person who's actually receiving the care.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the person actually receiving care? Paint that picture, because people can understand the coordination piece of it. People can understand all the different nonprofits involved. Talk a little bit about the kind of folks who you're reaching out to who are involved in this, and why it's really important to get them the care they need.
Right now, North Carolina is still one of the states that has not expanded Medicaid access. So we're talking about our eligible folks who are on managed care, and that is relatively new. Mostly it is women and children, pregnant women, folks with disability, who are eligible for Medicaid in North Carolina now. Although I will say that there is a bill out right now that would expand Medicaid in North Carolina. So as I describe this, there is great potential in the next few months that this eligibility pool will instantly expand. And we're very hopeful about that. But it's a narrow set. It's not everyone with Medicaid managed care. So in order to really understand the impact, the demonstration waiver, the support that we got from the feds, said that we need to narrow in. And so that means these are folks who've already had a diagnosis of some kind. So it could be a diabetes diagnosis. We know any child that is born prematurely is instantly eligible for this program. And so we have all these individuals who are already navigating the healthcare system. They already have a physician who has diagnosed and is supporting them. And now we can layer on these additional supports. And one of, I think, the most beautiful things about these is that if one person in your household is eligible, they have Medicaid managed care, a child with an asthma diagnosis, it supports the whole family. So we can bring in healthy home goods, the HEPA filter that helps create a clean air environment in the household, the food boxes that can be delivered for food access serve the whole family. And it helps bring everyone together in this sort of support system. So you need one eligible member in your in the household to get this going.
So then tell us a little bit about some of the partners you've got, some of the nonprofits.
They are phenomenal. These are groups that have been working in our community for decades in some cases. So one that I'll highlight right here in Asheville is ABIPA. They have community health workers who are engaged and connected to the community. They have trusting relationships with folks who have healthcare needs. And they are supporting connecting people to the resources that they need. So one of the ways that that happens is, you know, to go back to the folks that we're talking about who are the most or who are targeted for this program, who are meant to benefit from it. They may not have a healthy relationship with the healthcare system. They may not have been treated well, or they may have family history where someone else was not treated well. And we have households that have mixed immigration status. And so they may be worried about accessing resources because it might invite folks into their homes. And so when you have a partner like ABIPA who already has trusting relationships and they can draw down these resources to better support the whole family, we just have a greater chance that these families are going to have what they need to thrive.
Okay. ABIPA, is that an acronym?
It is. Let's see if I can do it justice if Joanna is out there listening. It's the Asheville Buncombe Institute of Parity Achievement. They came into practice with an emphasis on health equity and serving communities of color right here in Asheville and Buncombe counties.
Why do we need this? This is a pretty wealthy country we've got here. There's certainly plenty of people who have access to all the things you're talking about, transportation, a house, food. Generally, there's a correlation we're all aware of. I think common knowledge, when you have those things, you tend to be pretty healthy. Why did we have to go through this? We have a demonstration. We have measurements. Why do we need to think about this so hard?
That's a really good question. And it's, I think, a source of frustration for a lot of folks that this just seems like common knowledge. Like you said, it just seems like the right thing to do. We spend a lot of money on healthcare in this country, and we get worse outcomes than most other industrialized nations in the world who are spending less on healthcare than us. But when you expand that focus on where money is being spent in places that have better health outcomes, it's because they already get this. They already know that safe housing and good food to eat and transportation to not just your doctor's office and work, but also to a community center that's offering social connection and a nice pickup game of basketball. Those things are more common in other industrialized nations. And so with our unique healthcare system here in the U.S., we have to figure out how to work it in. So if we, you know, historically, our healthcare systems, our insurance groups have not paid for social health needs like housing. And so we need to prove that it works here too, so that we can get folks to listen and sustain and expand this. So again, thinking about the group that's eligible right now, we at Impact Health and with our partnerships see this as the starting point, not the ending point. Because if we can show the impact and get people engaged now and understanding how critical this is, and that it can be done, because it is complex. You know, you heard me list out all those stakeholders that are needed to make this go. Those relationships weren't in place before this demonstration project in a lot of cases. And so part of what the funding is, we get capacity building dollars. They come down through a federal allocation and the state matches it dollar for dollar to help put the systems in place that aren't here yet. The social safety network in our region, strong in some places and has big gaping holes in others. And then we also have the unique work that we have to do here in the region that connects rural services. So we have all of these systems that aren't fully serving our communities in the ways that we would want them to. And we have to prove that layering on these safety nets is functional, is practical, and will be cost effective here in our settings.
One of the big things is they need to be able to talk to each other, which is, you know, probably people would never even think about that. The administrative overhead of allowing all these different things to connect, for one entity to be able to identify who the people are, how can we report our metrics in for how well this is working, or who needs help, or what kind of help they need. So that's, is that something that is covered with the funding?
It is. There's a, you'll hear a collective groan from some of the stakeholders right now. We have a really interesting system. It's called NC Care 360, which is intended to create referral loops, you know, because that's one of the things you think about that all the time. You go to the doctor and they say, you know, you got this thing on your skin, I'm going to refer you out to a dermatologist. And they do that in their electronic records. And so they send it out and you go see the dermatologist, and then the report comes back to your doctor and they say, oh, I see you saw the dermatologist and it was nothing. And that's great news. That system has never been in place for social health. Like, I see that your family, your household is food insecure. I'm going to refer you out to this food pantry to get connected. And then that's typically where it's ended, if that was even happening at all. And so NC Care 360 is a platform that allows that closed loop referral, so that when the physician makes this referral out, they can find out, did you actually get connected? Did you get some food service? Did you get meals delivered, or maybe a fruit and vegetable prescription to help support you? And that level of communication is very new. It's also a brand new platform with a whole lot of new users who are trying to figure out how to use it best. It requires training and time and commitment. And so when I say a collective groan, it's an addition to the workflow. Let's say this, your job is how it has been for 2 decades because you worked in this nonprofit. Now you have this new database that you have to work with. And it's not only information flow, but that's also how the billing and payment system happens. So that's where these nonprofits can then drop a claim that Impact Health helps to support and then loops it back. And so you get this really amazing tapestry of data that then has to be peeled back and understood.
Are we doing this the hard way? When we talk about other countries and they have this built-in system, you just use the word tapestry. Some might say patchwork. Mm-hmm. And at some point, if you keep building little patchworks, it becomes more and more complex and it becomes harder to do. Are we doing that?
Oh, that's a hard one to answer. I think people are complex, and recognizing all the different ways they show up in systems and data points are hard to navigate sometimes. I don't think there is a one solution for any community or family. And so, yes, it's very complex. I think in this country, our approach to healthcare tends to be modify, tweak, shift rather than overhaul. And I think in order to make this vastly less complex, it would be that overhaul space.
It is Innovation Day.
It is Innovation Day.
It's Innovation Day. Yeah. So do you feel like, and there's a couple other stakeholder groups, I'm going to start with healthcare providers. Do you feel like the healthcare providers are on board?
The ones who know about it, absolutely. So it's been tough to get the word out. And, you know, because it's such a narrow set of folks who are eligible for this, we've had to walk the line of casting the right net and not too broad a net, because we know there is great social need across the region. And the last thing we want to do is get somebody really excited about this new support system and find out that they're not eligible. So we're trying to be really intentional in our outreach. And so we you know, right now, for example, we're working with North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, who oversees Medicaid for North Carolina and are the leaders in this demonstration project. They're trying to help us understand where these eligible members are so we can work more directly with the healthcare providers. Physicians get it. It is endlessly frustrating to them that they'll be trying to support someone's health outcomes and know that 80% of the weight that will get someone well or help them navigate an illness happens completely outside of their office. So they're very aware of it. And those who are able to connect to this program have been phenomenal, really understanding how this can benefit their patients. The problem is our physician groups, our healthcare practices see a lot of people. In order to enter into something this complex and be that focused on it for a tiny slice, it's just really hard. It's hard for them to do it. So they care very much about it. They understand the impact. And then the practical implementation, I think, is really the benefit of this demonstration site, is like to work out the kinks.
Right. And that's what Impact Health is trying to do, is kind of fill in to support the physician practices.
Exactly. We work with MAHEC, for example. The Mountain Area Health Education Center is a really important part of the healthcare infrastructure for our region. And one of the things that they offer to the community is practice support. So they're trying to help practices be efficient and effective and get to the best possible health outcomes for the folks that they're caring for. And they're one of our partners in helping physician practices understand and connect and participate in this demonstration project.
Is there a list of conditions or qualifications for someone who's on in Medicaid managed care to be able to say, oh my gosh, that would fit for me. I mean, you mentioned diabetes, but I'm sure, well, I guess that's my question. Is there a list of conditions?
There is. Yes, there is a list for children who have access. They need to have one condition on the list. And for adults, they need to have two in order to be eligible for this pilot. And rather than give you the laundry list, I'd like to invite folks, we don't want anyone to self-select out. We would like you to try and get screened so that you'll know for sure if you're eligible. So you can visit our website, which is www.impacthealth.org, and you'll see a big orange button that says, am I eligible? And it'll ask you those questions. So it is a diagnosis of a condition. So again, diabetes is always the one that comes fastest to mind. So one eligibility, for example, would be to have a BMI that is identified as 30 plus, which in the medical language would be considered obesity plus diabetes, and you would find yourself eligible. We also have some plans that aren't launched yet. So, and you know, in terms of being a demonstration, we're continually adding pieces to this work. And so one of the Medicaid managed care transitions that's underway is called tailored plans. And those plans support folks who have more complex behavioral health needs. And so those types of diagnoses will also open the door for folks to be eligible for this program.
Can you elaborate on those behavioral health needs and even the tailored plan? Because I think that's something that people might not be aware of.
Yeah, that is still a learning space for me as well. It's very detailed, but our tailored plans are meant to serve folks who have a mental health diagnoses, complex mental health diagnoses. So things like depression, anxiety. I will run out of the list. You can tell that I'm not that kind of doctor. Mine's in public health instead of clinical, but really helping people who have generally that intersection of mental health need and physical health need. So it could be a kidney disease plus a depression diagnosis that will help them access more complicated care. And I'm sure that there are folks out there cringing right now as I'm not describing this as clearly as I'd like to.
Tell us a little bit more. Are payers on board? Have you been working with health insurance companies?
We have. There are five private insurers that are in the traditional plans, and then a handful more that are coming on with our tailored plans to support. And there is great interest from these groups, just like the physicians that I mentioned before. They recognize the impact of having a high quality of life and support system on healthcare costs. And for example, I've had some really rich discussions with the folks who lead Medicaid work for Blue Cross. It's called Healthy Blue. And this is actually work that they're implementing in non-Medicaid populations as well. So they really do see the value and are optimistic that we'll keep this in place. The place where it starts to get a little tricky with our plans is the great reliance in this program on care management. So if you've ever been diagnosed with something, or maybe you've recently come out of the hospital and you have someone give you a call and see how they can support you in navigating through your diagnosis or your post-op care or whatever it is, those are care managers. They're typically a nurse by training, and their work is to get to know you and meet you where you are, to guide you through to a healthy outcome, maybe to keep you out of the hospital if you've had to go in, or to help you avoid a crisis related to a chronic condition. And those folks are typically funded through our health plans to support folks navigating these illnesses. They're a critical part of the way that this healthy opportunities approach is working, because they now have the ability to support and refer people to the social health needs. So previously it was really purely clinical. You might know that the person you're supporting has unstable housing right now, and you might be able to say, hey, you know, you really should call the housing authority, but that would be where it ended. Now they can hear the sum total and see the whole person and the family and the housing situation and connect them to resources from the whole spectrum of care, from social health through to clinical care. And that is a time intensive and complex relationship. And so in order to staff that well, it's tough to get those connections.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, do we have enough of those people?
I don't think we have enough of those people. I think, you know, in order to make this really function, we need more dedicated care management staff to this. There's a group right here in Asheville that does incredible work, and they're interesting partially because this was already a part of their approach. So Mission Health Partners is a group. They came together around, you might remember from the Affordable Care Act days, something called an accountable care organization. And their goal goal was called the triple aim. They wanted people to be well, they wanted costs contained, and they wanted folks to feel good about their treatment. So not just to be well, but to be seen and supported and really feel like the high quality of care was there. And the model, so that was mainly supporting older adults through the, they called it the Medicaid Shared Savings Program. It was, can we do these things? Can we manage folks' care in a way that meets that triple aim? And now there's a fourth aim too. It's that the healthcare providers also feel supported and treated well, because I think we know a lot of burnout in the field is related to billing and cost containment and all of that sort of stuff. Folks don't join the medical field as nurses or doctors or practitioners because they like paperwork. They care about people.
Do these folks have to be clinicians, meaning licensed nurses, doctors?
Care management in its traditional model does rely on some medical knowledge because of that navigation of clinical diagnoses. But something that we are trying to work on now is really engaging that community health worker model. So these are folks whose skills really are in making connections, helping people get the resources that they need and understanding sort of the field. And so if we could connect these care managers and community health workers, we could get a greater range of support. So we're trying to lay out that strategy right now because community health workers are not volunteers. It's a profession.
Right.
And they need to be paid as well. And so trying to figure out what that financial model is to engage community health workers to be paid for the skills that they bring into this is really critical.
Speaking of getting paid, how do insurance companies work? What is their expectation on return? What kinds of measurements are they looking at? And what's their role in connecting community health workers with care coordinators, working with you, or if any?
So the payment model is definitely one thing. That is something that is a part of the demonstration, is really to understand what the best payment model approach is for social health. Right now, it's a fee-for-service model. So as our human service organizations, we say HSO for shorthand. We have an endless supply of abbreviations in this demonstration. It's been fun to figure it all out. But those human service organizations, in the demonstration, we had two pots of money. The first one was capacity building. So we're asking these organizations who have operated, you know, for generations in some of our communities, some are newer, but we're asking them to change the way they operate. So they need funding, they need a training and technical assistance to be able to put the systems in place that will help them deliver against this. And so that's been the bulk of our dollars invested in the region to date. It's a little over $6 million has come into Western North Carolina to support these nonprofits. Some of it's been hiring, some of it's been literally purchasing a van to help deliver food. And so we're now shifting away from capacity building dollars into seeing if the claims are actually self-sustaining. So now that they're up and running, are they delivering enough food boxes to pay for the process? And then the way that the health plans come as a part of the demonstration, right now it's pass-through money. There's really no incentive to decline or avoid any of those claims that are coming in. It's a benefit. Every time we can connect someone to a resource, it actually helps our health plans get to better health outcomes. But we need to track that. So we're tracking the dollars spent and we're tracking the health outcomes and, you know, trying to understand where the impact is. I will say the research is not happening at the local space. So we have two state partners. One is Duke Margolis and the other is the Shep Center at UNC, who are really trying to take both a quantitative approach, really looking at the dollars and cents, and a qualitative approach to understand the story behind the numbers and the changes to quality of life, not just quantity of healthcare units.
How big is this pool of folks? Could it be bigger? Is there obviously going to be improvement when you're so far gone that, you know, it seems easy to move the needle?
When I think about how this was set up, so I joined this process in October. It had already been underway for about a year. And then several years of planning before that. So sometimes I'm looking at this as an outsider, which I think is useful sometimes. I can see how some of the structures were set up to be able to measure impact. And it is tough to measure impact when you look at an otherwise healthy population. So right now, we have loads of people who have Medicaid access who are healthy. They have no chronic conditions. They have no immediate healthcare needs, but they do have critical health, social health needs that will eventually come back around. You know, they won't have the high health outcomes that they could have had if they had safe housing, for example. So it's tough to study that group over 5 years, because how do you study what didn't happen with a group that was already healthy? And so there was an intention to look at folks who were already in a clinical setting. That's another important point, because even if you have health insurance, you have Medicaid, you have private insurance, you may still be making a decision between going to the doctor's office and having groceries this week. So even insurance is not always covering the cost of really accessing medical care. And so when we think about all of these sort of mixed up pieces, we started out by tracking the sickest. That's the bottom line. The folks who we might be able to see. So here's an example that one of my former colleagues used to use all the time. So you have an individual who keeps showing up in the emergency room in diabetic crisis. Their insulin is off the charts or non-existent, and they're approaching a coma. And they have to come into the ED to be stabilized or they will die. When they get in there, they get stabilized, they get a new supply of insulin, and they go home. And in 3 months, they're right back in the same situation. And no one can really understand. They do have access to insulin, but they keep showing up in crisis. And so finally, a healthcare social worker maybe has a conversation with them to find out they don't have a refrigerator. And in order for insulin to stay active, it has to be refrigerated. And so by getting a refrigerator in that individual's apartment, maybe it costs $300, you maybe prevent 4 multi-$1,000 emergency room visits over the course of a year. And so that's a really easy way to say, look at what this one investment changed. And it maybe, as a side note, provided dignity and human connection for this person who was finally seen as a whole person, not just as a patient with diabetes. And so that's what I think some of the structure of how this is set up with such a narrow group gives us the chance to maybe show a pretty quick impact of how this can change the finances of Medicaid.
One of the first things that brings up to me is where's you getting the feed for people to participate in this program? Because it seems like the providers and the payers have so much information. The person that you mentioned, you know, the example that you just gave, both the provider and the payer, the insurance company, would have a lead to be able to say to you, you know, here's a candidate for your program. Is that something that's happening?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, because we are using something we're calling the no wrong door approach. We want to meet people where they are. And in some cases, that trusted relationship is with the physician or the nurse at the practice that they see every time they come to sign in. And those folks are able to make referrals into the system. They eventually need to get back to that care manager who can coordinate all of the needs. But they may not be connected to our healthcare system yet. So one of the other doors they could take is maybe they regularly pick up food from their church food pantry. So that food pantry could say, hey, you might be eligible for some more support systems, and we might be able to get some funding to support you if you would get screened for this. So our human service organizations are able to screen for eligibility as well and get them entered into the system. And then there's self-referral. So I hope that some of your listeners today are thinking, I might be eligible for this. And that's where you can call Impact Health, or you can call the number on the back of your Medicaid managed care. There's a phone number on the back of that for customer support or member support services. Or you can go to our website and do a very quick, you can pull it up on your phone. And again, that's www.impacthealth.org. And you'll see a big orange button that says, am I eligible? And you'll answer a few questions, and then you'll be in the system, and a care manager can call again and coordinate those supports for you.
Are there policies or philosophies that make the burden of proof for this pilot greater than perhaps regular folks might think?
That's tough. There are so many proof points that individuals navigating poverty or healthcare systems or education have to do to prove that they have need. And so this is analogous to that, is similar. You have to prove need. I hope that we can get to a proof point with this where simply having access to Medicaid recognizes that you already have social needs. It's unlikely for you to be eligible for Medicaid and not also need support. But right now, in order to get access, when that care manager calls you, there's a questionnaire that needs to be worked through to help identify not only are you eligible, but then what are the basic needs that we need to connect for you. And it's time consuming.
The other side of that question is, to what degree are the people you serve responsible for their diabetes, their lack of transportation, their unaffordable housing? Some would argue that they play a role in that. How realistic is that?
I will step up onto my soapbox for just a minute. We talk a lot about social drivers of health. So these systems of education, housing, finance, access to care, even social connectivity, so social networks. Those are all social drivers of health. And the work of this demonstration site is targeting something I would call social need. So we have these systems and they operate in ways that end up with people who do not have enough to eat and people who have so much money they could never spend it in a lifetime. And so these inequalities are exacerbated across these systems. They layer up. So when I think about improving the social need of people who are hungry today or have unstable housing today, and we can help meet that need within the system, we are creating a healthier community. But we aren't necessarily changing those systems that lead to housing instability. So there's the individual who's housing insecure today that we want to support. But by supporting that individual, we're not necessarily changing the system that created it. And so we need a lot of partners engaged with that. And, you know, one of the partners here regionally, the Dogwood Health Trust, that is their focus. They are focused on the systems and they're trying to fund organizations who are doing that. So when we do this in tandem and we can pull this data in to help people see, these are the outcomes of these inequitable systems that are damaging households, are damaging individuals, and we need to fundamentally change those. And so there's the basic need, and then there are layers underneath that, and it's what Dr. Kamara Jones calls the social drivers of health inequity. So we talk about inequitable health outcomes. So for example, in Buncombe County, our birth outcomes are vastly different by race. Black women have significantly worse maternal and child health outcomes in our community. It's not just what happens in clinical care. It's that we have great inequities in housing by race in our community. We have great inequities in academic opportunity in our communities. And so we have to look at these layers of the systems and the now. I used to be a bit of a purist that you got to focus on the systems. We got to just change these things. And then I had Dr. Olson Huff said to me once, he said, yes, we do. But there are people who are hurting right now, and we have to focus. We can do two things. We can focus on the drivers and the needs, and that's what we're trying to do here, I think.
What's really exciting about what you're saying is you're giving people the truth, which is maybe we need systemic change, but we can't wait for systemic change. We have to do something right now, and your organization's doing that. Let's get into some more solutions. Lori, if you had a suggestion for folks, what would it be?
That's a long wish list. But right now it's about enrolling people. We have these services, we have the funds to provide them, and we want to make sure that every single person who is eligible takes advantage of it if it helps, if they want to be involved. And so for anyone really considering how they could lean in right now is take this information out, talk to folks who they're, I keep coming across friends that I didn't know had access to this program and have connected. So personal word of mouth really matters here. When we have so many systems that don't support people in the way that they need to be supported, it creates a lot of distrust and wariness, and that is understandable. And so that no wrong door approach that we're talking about, you might be one of those doors. You might open it and help someone connect to the resource that they need in this moment and today. So I think that's one of the things that I would ask people to think about is how can you spread the word and get people access to the resources they have?
I know for myself, the first thing that jumps to my mind is the providers, the large providers, not the individual doctor around the corner, and the health plan. Send me a list of all the people in the past year who have accessed care for these conditions. And that's the start point of your hit list. And that's like, you know, if I worked at one of those places, that's something that I could even generate that list for you. So I just have to imagine that's got to be, instead of it having to come from the outside, it can come right from the source.
That's definitely one of the doors. There's a lot of care that we have to take there because your health data is extremely private. So legally private and personally. Folks don't really like to hear from a stranger who says, hey, I know these health issues about you and you're eligible for this program. So we are trying to think about what that approach looks like. We know that it is possible to generate those lists and create those outcomes. We want to make sure that the messenger is the right person. So a cold call from someone you've never interacted with before who knows about your health information can be very off-putting. So we want to create relationships with organizations that can help. And one of those right doors is with our community organization. So they're starting to screen folks who already come for some service or another to see if they are eligible for this program and maybe eligible for more services. So maybe right now they're regularly picking up a food box, but they don't show up this week. And so one of the workers from that human service organization can give them a call. They find out that their car's broken down and they just can't get there anymore. And so two things, they might be able to shift to delivering that food access. And if they are eligible for this program, we can help with car repairs. We can help get that vehicle back on the road, get it safely functioning, and get them back connected to the resources. Because I think we all know, you know, there but for the grace of God go I, with car repairs, it can upend your entire life and take away any of those gains you've made to have more stable housing or a better job. And so those pieces can come. So yes to the, yes, there is a list somewhere that we know every eligible person. And how do we leverage that to best connect people in the way that makes them feel trust and belonging?
So how would you change how we deploy the resources, the potential need for more community health workers or care managers? How would you change how state, local, federal governments are thinking about deploying resources to support this?
I'm going to give you a really wonky answer, I'm afraid. Right now, I think so much of healthcare is provided on fee-for-service. You perform this thing, it gets paid this much. A lot of shifts are happening now to something called capitated care. We'll give you this much money to give this keep this person healthy for a year. I think we need to approach that in the same way for social health needs. It's a pretty significant burden on our nonprofits to drop a claim for every single food box they deliver or every single housing navigation session they provide. It's pretty burdensome. And you know who's been yelling that for years? Our practices, our physician groups have been saying it's very burdensome to get exactly the right coding and drop exactly the right claim, sometimes for it just to be denied. And then you have to rework the system. So this sort of bundling of care and knowing that if we have strong human service organizations operating in our regions, who have reliable income, so they know how much they're going to be paid to serve a population of people, it cuts out some of that red tape and makes it a more stable process. It is tougher to track individual level outcomes that way. But if we tie it all together from the human service organization to the insurance provider to the state and the clinical provider, we can start to tease out that story and understand where those impacts are happening. But I think that's one of those systems that is really burdensome, is to charge a fee for every single action.
So, you know, the managed care companies for Medicare do that now. The payer gets a higher premium if the patient has certain different conditions. So the basis for that model and for putting something like that in place on that end already exists.
Yeah, explain a little bit more about capitation, and you take a person and you look at their complete set of needs and you get a payment for all of them. So transportation, housing, food, medical care, here's your bundle for that, and then I manage against that. Is that how that works?
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. It's understanding the whole and complex needs of the individual, and rather than saying everybody needs this, it's what do you need? It's really that patient-centered care and broadening the scope of patient into person, because they're not just always in a clinical setting.
So tell us a little bit about misconceptions people might have that you've heard about these folks. I'm suggesting that because there could be people out there who have the attitude of, why are we spending all this money on folks? Shouldn't they be helping themselves?
Yeah, I have heard that one, believe it or not. There is, I think, a deep lack of understanding of what it is like to live in poverty if you have never experienced it yourself. The mental load of navigating systems and access points just to get by makes it almost impossible to get out of survival mode and into a space of comfort and stability. And so this gives folks just that little bit of breathing room that may give them the opportunity to find a better work or something that's closer to home or more fulfilling. It may have better night's sleep, and it allows people to lean into their potential. But if we are asking people to do that all on their own, we're asking too much. This is Appalachia. We care about our neighbors. We know that some days your neighbor stumbles, but some days it's you. And so we lean back and forth and we try to be there for each other. And I think that that is one of the things we're seeing happen in this pilot, is that the way people are showing up for each other and caring, but now that's being recognized with financial compensation and making it more stable and long term, we're going to see some real change. So I think that's where if anybody thinks that they do it all by themselves, I think they're missing a lot of great parts of their lives where they're getting partnership help and support. And so everyone deserves that dignity of care and support and recognition that it's really hard to do any of this alone.
Talk a little bit about two or three examples you can think of where folks take something for granted that just doesn't exist for some of the folks that are in your program.
A top of that list for me is reliable transportation. It is incredibly expensive to own and maintain a vehicle. And in Western North Carolina, there are so many spaces that don't have any kind of public transportation or public infrastructure for transportation. And so the ability to walk outside and turn the key in your ignition and A, know that it will turn on, and B, that there will be enough gas to get you to and from the places you go. If you have those resources, I think you forget about how hard it is, how impossible it is to operate without that. And so if you lose access to a vehicle or you have a flat tire, that can be hundreds of dollars. And then you may not make it to work on time. And then you get a ding on your employment record where you may lose your job at some point soon. You can't get your kid to childcare. Or maybe it happens midday and you can't pick your kid up from childcare on time and you get charged for that. So there are all these hidden fees, I think, that we don't pay attention to, or we have the safety net or the friend that can help with some repairs. It's just, I think, incredible if you just go one day without any access to your personal vehicle and try to figure out how to do everything you intended to do that day on time and with your head fully in the game. I think that's a huge one.
So I think one step you're talking about is, you know, put yourself in someone else's shoes. What are some of the other things that people can do today as they think about both your organization and the people it serves?
Yeah, empathy building is always a great place to start. And then, you know, recognizing, think about the community organizations that exist around you and the kind of work that they're doing and whether or not there's a way you could support that directly. One of the cornerstones of the Healthy Opportunities demonstration and the work of Impact Health is to ensure that we have a stable network of nonprofits and human service organizations that are doing this good work in the community. This is just a slice of their whole. We do hope that clinical dollars, so clinical care money coming into our human service organization networks, will be a source of stable income to help keep them doing the great work that they're doing. But it's not enough. There are other folks that these organizations that are serving that are not funded by this, but who have the same needs. And so thinking about how to really ensure that the groups in your community that are doing this good work are seen and supported, because Impact Health, that's our primary goal. It's, you know, we're not out front. We're in the back trying to make sure that these groups have what they need to serve the populations that they already serve.
Is any of this, I know it's coming from Medicaid, that's a national program. Is any of this coming from state and local taxes?
Oh, absolutely. So the way that this demonstration project is set up, first, that capacity building money that I mentioned that helped to infuse systems and skill sets and those sorts of things in our networks, that is matched dollar for dollar, federal and state. So it comes out of our state tax dollars to help stabilize those pieces. And then Medicaid is also shared costs, federal and state, that supports it. And then we have the benefit at Impact Health of also having some private dollars from Dogwood Health Trust to support this work and really stabilize it, because we think the network and infrastructure that's being built by this demonstration is here for the long haul. There are always going to be a need to connect these amazing nonprofits and human service organizations around the region to providing services. So right now the payer is Medicaid, but maybe next year it's more private insurance. We got to find a solution for getting these services to the un and underinsured. So those are also on our radar. So yeah, there are state, local, and national finances involved in this work.
Well, this is really important work. It's been great to have you here. We're going to have to go, Lori, but I hope folks get a lot from this, because I think the Healthy Opportunities pilot is a big deal. People obviously need it. And just thank you very much for coming in.